Welcome to Changing the Conversation. This podcast explores the mix of diversity, culture, and tech innovations in our industry. Join us as we sit down with trailblazers, thought leaders, and innovators who are reshaping the landscape of insurance, bringing you stories that redefine the narrative. We are your guide to the evolving landscape of insurance. This is Changing the Conversation, brought to you by Mackay. Brian, welcome to Changing the Conversation. I am so excited to have you back on the podcast. So thank you for agreeing.
Yeah, it's brilliant to be here.
So we've had some kind of conversations offline about the topic that we wanted to talk about. And I think I'll just introduce that we've previously had a chat around the future of insurance and the book series that you guys, you writing, and now it's kind of building out, isn't it?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I wonder if you just want to give a bit of an overview about who you are and what we're doing, I suppose.
Sure. So I'm an insurance industry veteran and primarily P&C. Insurance within that, but I've worked in the space for about the past 25 years, a lot of time at carriers, kind of general insurance, you know, big standard lines kind of stuff. But I also spent a decade in specialty lines and worked with a couple UK based carriers on their US business. And I was really lucky and excited for this very cool career that gave me exposure to many different functional areas and lines of business and geographies and different market mechanisms and all sorts of things. And I've spent the last few years kind of building off of that and engaging in InsurTech and trying to help the industry move forward. And as you mentioned, you know, I've been putting out a book series that aims to do that, you know, helping us all sort of say, or stop saying, I should say, we can't because, as we look at all of these constraints in the industry, you know, regulation and pricing and whatever else, and instead say, well, how might we? Right? There's so much we want to achieve. There's so much the world needs of us because of how critical insurance is. Well, how might we do that better? And it's kind of a fun way I get to spend my days. So that's me in a nutshell.
Well, that how might we, since last time we spoke, has actually been quite pivotal in my own life, because I really resonated with it, and I love the idea. You've touched on a number of different things that you've done, and you've given us some great sound bites for recruitment in the insurance industry. So thanks for that.
Good.
What we're really talking about today from our previous discussions is around how the insurance industry has to adapt to external challenges. And I'm thinking climate change, I'm thinking yep. supply chain issues, social challenges, and one of the kind of titles that came up for our discussion is around this cyclical downturn or fundamental shift.
Yeah.
Insurance profitability versus customer need. I wonder if you can just talk to me a little bit about the thoughts that sparks in your head and your kind of belief in it, I suppose.
Sure. So, and apologies to anyone who's heard me living on this soapbox for the past few months, but, you know, when you hear, you said cyclicality, when we hear about the cycle, this is not a new term in insurance. Rates go up, rates go down, profitability goes up and down. You know, we have bad storms, people lose a lot of money, rates harden and they make money. This is the norm. This is the way insurance has always been. We seem to have that going on right now, but I don't think it's driven by any of the same things. And I don't think it's a cycle. I think it's a shift. And that's, you know, you mentioned some of them, but we sort of had this baseline of what is capital and how does it work and how does it move around the world, you know, all the way up through even the early 2000s. I think it was really around the great financial crisis in 2008, where the way capital works in the world started to change and it became much more fluid and much more global in nature. So normally we would have, you know, spent up all this money on losses or unprofitability, and then rates harden because there isn't enough capacity. And so there's a lack of supply for all that demand. Capital doesn't work that way anymore. It's not just a pot of money that, you know, is sat in the London market or Bermuda or the US or Germany or wherever. It's totally fungible. It moves around. It's coming from the Middle East. It's coming from Asia. It's all over. So I don't see us having these swings in capital anymore. that means when we have swings in macroeconomic factors affecting the cost of exposures, the cost of risk transfer, like climate change, like supply chain, like inflation, like social inflation, all of the things that are going on right now, all at the same time. And then you add in labor shortages, both for ourselves and for our insureds and for our intermediaries. These are very strong macroeconomic complications that are changing the dynamics of risk and the cost of risk. And capital just keeps flowing. So we don't have the normal reactions we're used to for the past 300 years. And that means we're at a very difficult spot where, and this is front page news in many developed insurance markets, where insurers lost a great deal of money, certainly last year, and for some much longer than that. And so they need to raise rates and restrict coverage. But at the same time, insureds cannot afford the level of rate change that's coming in. So you're in this conundrum where an insurer can't afford to sell insurance at a commercially viable cost because no one can afford to buy it. And for insureds, they can't afford to buy insurance that could be sold to them. They can only afford to buy underpriced insurance at today's rates. So you're in this conundrum where insurance is neither affordable to buy or to sell at a market clearing rate. And that is the fundamental shift. That's not a cycle. That's not rates are a bit harder and then they'll soften and just wait it out or vice versa. This is about figuring out a completely new way to address the market. And what I see most carriers doing is the typical responses. Just raise rates, pull out of some markets. You know, I look at really large carriers pulling out of some markets, and that's fine when you're bleeding. You know, if there's a particular hotspot, you need to stem your losses, totally fine. But that's not really a strategy. That's not a long-term play. That's a short-term band-aid. If you're a $20 billion carrier or $1 billion or £1 billion or whatever, you can't just pull back in all these markets and stay out of them when the fundamentals have shifted because you can't compete in them anymore. You're not built to run at such small scale. You can't go from 20 billion to 500 million and expect to survive. Your cost structure won't allow that. You must look for a different way to survive in this kind of environment. And I don't think it's temporal.
What's the answer here? Because you're talking about essentially a 180 degree turnabout in the way almost our global economy works because of how insurance and risk underpins that. What's the answer? Is there one?
Yeah, well, I think probably most people who are kind of veterans of the industry are hearing this and thinking I'm crazy, and that's fine. But I think our combined ratios would back me up rather than them. And I think if you look at the factors involved, I think that backs me up as well. Now, whether it's as extreme or, you know, whatever, we can debate that on the margins. But the general principle, I think, is quite sound that the economic viability of the way we've been doing it is not there anymore. So what do we do about that? We can't simply raise rate or simply pull back in what we're offering. And that's where I think we need a different strategy. So there are a few things that I think we should be looking at. One is, it's not that we should pull back on coverage, but we need to look at whether the cover is actually relevant and appropriate for the state of affairs today. So for example, you look at the modern home policy, motor policy, et cetera. I shouldn't say modern because they're generally based on forms from the 1950s. Most of our commercial policies, by and large, have been here since some well before the 1950s. Now, you could say shipping is shipping, and so that looks the same. You know, we've got the Houthi rebels. We've got climate change disrupting, maritime patterns. These are not things that we faced in 1843 or wherever. You know, I'm not a maritime person, so I'm totally off on this, but these policies have been around for hundreds of years. I mean, that's what really started the whole insurance industry was shipping. We look at what a car is today. It certainly looks nothing like it did in the 1950s on the outside. But in principle, look, it's got four wheels. It goes back and forth and turns, and there's a steering wheel and brakes. That's kind of the same thing. No, it's completely different. Even just the materials it's made out of are completely different. The kind of alloys that are used, the sensors, the plastic content, the type of glass and like all of this is so wildly different from what existed when the conception of motor coverage and the wordings around it were built. And that's before we even get into EVs and autonomous vehicles and the cost of the sensors on them and the fact that these are moving data capture and recording and analysis devices, not just modes of transportation. I think the actual exposure is quite different to what the insurance product that covers it was designed for. And that to me is the sort of fundamental first order is we need to, and this is a we can't because versus how might we moment, we need to not tinker because we've iterated those policies forever. We need to stop tinkering on the margins of, oh, well, you know, we'll just change this deductible or this limit or add in this data privacy component. We need to start afresh, just like in the 1950s when those policies were written, and say, well, what is the exposure and what are the core coverages that are needed for it? And almost put on blinders to the old policy, because if we keep ourselves framed in the old world, we're just going to come up with an iterative version of it. I think if you can build coverage that's fit for the actual exposure, you're starting in a much better place. And then you have to get into how you analyze risk and price for it, which is the other piece of the puzzle, not just jack up rates on a fundamentally broken risk analysis and pricing model to begin with, because it's not fit for purpose.
This complete reassessment of or reevaluation of risk, coverage required, and the pricing models is happening, isn't it? And it's happening on, you know, quite a ground roots scale. And I know some of the case studies you've done in your Future of Insurance series actually is looking at some of these case studies.
Yeah.
What lessons can we learn from them that, you know, the big global carriers who are not as nimble are able to take back and start doing now?
So I do think that, the nice thing about the stories I've gotten to tell is the subject insurance companies vary dramatically in size and scale. And so that's where when someone holds up their size or their complexity or whatever as a reason why they can't, this is another we can't because. I've got an example that I've done a case study on that is bigger, more complex, or similarly complex at least, that has done something. And so this notion of we're too big and so we can't, or even we're too small, we don't have the resources, really? Well, here's someone smaller than you who's done it. So I would say we need to disabuse ourselves of a lot of these constraints and say, okay, all right, I accept we can't do this, but what if we could anyway? Let's dream a little bit. And what you find is folks are willing to look for new solutions that actually meet a need. So as an example, parametric is a really interesting space that gets, I think, a lot of hype discussion and then swearing off because it's not fit for purpose. Or when you look at it through an indemnity lens, I've talked to a number of underwriters who really get stuck on, but how do you know that they had a loss? I said, that's not relevant. You're evaluating through an indemnity lens where you have to go and verify the loss. That's not what parametric is. The loss is actually just that the criteria was met. So by that standard, they had a loss. It doesn't matter whether you go out to the property and have a look around. That's a different product. That's like saying, you know, I went to the movies and I didn't understand why I wasn't swimming. It's like, well, you didn't go to a swimming pool. You went to the movies. So stop evaluating it, whether you were at the beach or a pool. I know that sounds ridiculous, but that's sort of what we're talking about here. So I've seen a few cases where a parametric cover has been used for a particular piece of the exposure that has gotten very difficult and very expensive to cover through a traditional indemnity policy. So for example, tornadoes. It's a very specific exposure, very specific loss. If your house is destroyed by a tornado, your homeowner's insurance will respond generally, but you'll have a wind deductible that's quite high. If you were to buy down that wind deductible, you probably couldn't afford the policy, and the insurer probably wouldn't want to sell it because it wouldn't be economically viable. So there's a parametric solution for tornado that is not meant to buy you a new house. It pays on a schedule based on the intensity of the storm, and they use National Weather Service data, it's a US policy, to understand if you're within these polygons that the Weather Service draws and what the intensity was listed in that polygon, and it pays out based on the schedule. yes, they send you a text to see if you're okay and to see if you need the assistance, but they will pay it regardless because you were in that trigger zone. If you got $5,000 because you had a certain storm come through, that may not be enough to pay for your home, you know, being rebuilt. It's not meant to be, but it would be enough to cover your $5,000 wind deductible that you couldn't afford to buy down to zero or $1,000. And it's a much more cost-effective policy, both to deliver and to purchase. These are, I mean, it's such a like a minute part of the problem, but it's solutions like that that I take hope from, because I look at that and say, okay, we've got something that for people who are in tornado-prone areas, this is a very real problem. For a national carrier, they probably don't care that much about it, but we do need to figure out how do we make that work. And you blow that up to something like hail damage, which that same solution provider is looking at. It's an MGA. Hail is the reason why by June of last year, the overwhelming majority of U.S. insurers had already met their annual cat exposure limit with their reinsurers. So they're already at their attachment point without a single named storm just because of hail activity. It's not hard to understand that insuring against hail and paying for it is not really viable anymore. And there are actually some carriers who closed down in the Midwest of the U.S. where it's seemingly just constantly hailing. We need a different solution for that. And I understand it's not going to buy you a new home or buy you a new car, but for you to pay for something that would, you can't afford that. And for an insurer to provide it at a cost that you could afford, they can't afford that. And that's to my point, is we need to look at what does insurance mean? Maybe it doesn't keep buying people new homes or new cars or, you know, whatever the cover is for, but it allows them to not be destroyed financially in the process. It's partial insurance in that sense. But there are probably pockets where economically that makes more sense for the buyer and the seller than how we've been treating it so far. And I wonder if we carve some of those things out, do we end up with a more viable product on both sides of the market? And we can use better data and more efficient processes to get us there. But it really ultimately is about the indemnity and the exposure and the cost of that risk. It's not about shaving points of expense ratio to just be more efficient about it. We should be efficient, but the majority of carriers who lost money last year, even if you reset their expense ratio to zero, they'd still be losing money. So this isn't about like, we need to get 2% of our expense ratio off. That's not going to make any difference.
I think it's really fascinating because we're talking about being on the cusp of an age-old industry that has got to reform in quite a significant way.
Yeah.
What should Lloyd's in the London market be doing now, being so pivotal in global insurance product development? What sort of things are you seeing and not seeing but would like to see?
Yeah. Well, I do think Lloyd's is really interesting in that if you look at syndicates or companies that are heavier in Lloyd's than they are out in open brokered business, their combined ratios were fantastic by and large last year. My old insurer wrote at a 75, they just announced. And, you know, as I said before we started recording, I was sort of kicking myself for selling my shares, but hey, that's what happens. And that is because it can respond much more rapidly. And quite frankly, Lloyd's has always been a place where coverage is dynamic and responsive, and it does so in real time. I mean, day by day, because there is so much bespoke coverage, there is so much manuscripting going on, and the risks are looked at quite individual levels, and the rates are derived at quite individual levels. I think that's one thing that Lloyd's can continue to do, is be willing to be flexible and opportunistic in creating and adjusting coverage to the needs and the balance of economics between the buyer and the seller. I think that's an important role that Lloyd's plays globally, even for those who don't play in the market or for lines of business that you would never find themselves in the London market. But I think the other side of it is Lloyd's is, and I don't mean this pejoratively, but it's not an efficient market. It's efficient in clearing risk, but operationally, and there's been tremendous efforts over the years to do that, but it's still a very expensive market to run. The fees are high, the systems costs are high, the cost of change, because it's this, you know, yes, there's the Lloyd's Corporation, but there's this sort of federated group of syndicates who participate in these working groups and trying to make change, and they all have to agree to it, even though they all work a bit differently. It ends up being quite cumbersome and expensive. I think that that is something that would be, I mean, if I could have my wish, it would be for someone to step up and be willing to take more of a directive stance on the right answer, which is not always the politically acceptable answer to all of the syndicates. But I think it needs a bit bolder leadership in that respect. And this is coming from someone who is not participating in the market, so it's easy for me to say that. But I've certainly been in those situations before where, you know, sometimes we do have to get tough with ourselves and say, you know, I appreciate you all have different views. There is a level of absolute correctness out there. And if we don't accept that and get honest with ourselves and not worry about the political blowback any one of us may face inside our own company for giving in on this thing that maybe isn't what our CIO or our CEO's pet project is, we are all going to continue to suffer, and that's unacceptable. So I would love to see, you know, a tougher stance on some things, and that may take different people being involved. I don't know. But I think Lloyd's, because of its very unique position, from a coverage standpoint and a marketplace standpoint, if it could be more of a leader from an operational standpoint and truly setting the stage for what, you know, fantastic systems and processing and interconnectedness as an industry could look like, that would be unreal, and quite an unlock for us all.
I'm listening to you speak. Your knowledge is outstanding. Like, you've got a really deep understanding of the market, the economic implications, but also a willingness to do things differently. And I absolutely love the "how might we." I love
it. Yeah, it's not mine. I did steal it, and I'm happy to give credit where credit's due. But it's brilliant. No one should hold it back.
Yeah, I think it's awesome. Your background, extensively in insurance, but also life coaching, mentoring, inspirational speeches, because from a personal perspective, you've done a lot of things to support and help personal and professional development. Do you want to tell me a little bit about that? Because I'm very inspired by you, and I find it really interesting.
Well, thank you. So I, you know, like everyone, I have a backstory and things that I've gone through. And I just came from a conference that my organization was running, and word got around about my backstory, and I used to be very overweight. And so that was like, you know, people were coming up like, "I heard this, that can't be true, right? Let me see a picture." But we all face difficulties in our lives. We all face challenges. And the funny thing is, I think this is exactly the same story for insurance. So I've written these kind of self-help books, and I've written these business books and insurance, and people are like, "I don't see the connection." I actually think it's all self-help or personal development, if you will, whether it's an individual in a company or an industry as a whole. We face some challenge that always feels too great. You know, you look up at the mountain and you think, you know, "I can't get up there. It's too big of a leap." But the thing I realized very long ago, I had 100 pounds to lose. You don't lose 100 pounds in a day. You don't get to the peak of the summit in one step. It's what you do in every step. It's what you do in every day that moves you forward. And you will make missteps. You will make backwards progress. You will go the wrong way at times. It's up to you whether you choose to throw it all away in the face of that. And, you know, you had a bad night, you ate too much at a party, and then you throw your all of your fitness out the window because it's ruined now. Or you say, "Well, hang on, I made a mistake. I'm going to learn from that. Maybe there were reasons why I chose what I chose. And for social reasons, it was it was the right thing to do for my happiness. But now I can make a different decision this morning. You know, we tried this product. We tried this new distribution method. It didn't work out. Are we going to bury that under the rug and fire the people behind it and never speak of it again? Or are we going to say, "Well, look, that didn't work out. Let's be honest about why. Maybe we didn't actually deliver what the customer wanted." I've seen that time and time again. They tell us what they want. We look at it from the lens of "we can't because," and, "Well, we're already working on this," or "our system can't do that," or "Well, regulators would never allow us to." And so we hamstring it before it's even become a thing. And then we wonder why it didn't succeed. let's be honest with ourselves about that and see, maybe we're a big part of why it didn't go well and we can do better next time. So that's how I've lived my life is I call it do a day, is every day I'm going to do the best thing that I can do for the goals I'm trying to achieve. And I think as an industry, we can do the same. You know, we face all sorts of constraints. We face mountains that are too big to climb. And yet we look around and there are some who have, you know, put on their backpacks and their hiking boots and they're off. And I like taking inspiration from that. And that's why I share the stories that I do. And hopefully it resonates with people.
It absolutely does. It completely resonates with me. I'm going to add to your how might we? And I'm going to say, how might we today? Mm. That's going to be my mantra. I'm going to write it on my wall. Yeah. And the second thing that really resonates with me, which speaks to what you're talking about, and I'm going to butcher the quote because I can't quite remember it, but it's essentially the person who succeeds has failed more times than you have tried.
Yeah.
And I really love that as well. Yeah. Brian, as always, I really enjoy speaking to you. I'm really grateful for your time and your knowledge. I just want to say thank you.
Thank you very much, Sarah. It's great to be back.
Thank you for tuning in to another enlightening episode of Changing the Conversation. If you enjoyed today's insights and want to stay connected with the latest industry trends, be sure to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. Feel free to reach out to us on social media or through our website to share your thoughts and suggestions, or even to nominate someone whose contribution deserves to be heard. Until next time, this is Sarah Myers-Goth signing off from Changing the Conversation.